proceed. The next matter before us is Broderick Aratoon versus Cheryl Roberts. Counsel, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
All right. We'd be delighted to hear from you.
My name is Ted Kavrikov, and I represent Broderick Aratoon. I'm representing him below, of course. This was a very difficult case. It was difficult in that we had a number of hearings. There were a number of accusations. There were a number of rulings which were hard to explain, at least in my mind. And the final outcome was that a person who was disabled was adjudged to not receive any spousal support, to go and find work, and to go and support himself, and most of all, to avail himself to governmental subsidies. So I believe that the issue of can a judge substitute spousal support with governmental subsidies, and can
whether it's a subsidy depends on how long you live, the way I understand the actuarial tables. I mean, obviously you contribute towards SSI during the course of your life.
Well, yeah, but we're not getting to that situation. What we have here is a situation where a person who is adjudged to be disabled, who cannot work, is told, listen, you're not entitled to spousal support because you can go out and get subsidies. Well, subsidies were speculative at that time, but I believe that what is the issue of first impression before this court is, can spousal support be substituted with subsidies provided by the government?
Can I interrupt you there?
Of course.
If it were framed that clearly, I think you'd probably get the answer you want, which is, I doubt any court's going to hold that spousal support ipso facto is, as a matter of law, not required if you can go hunt down some collateral source somewhere. But is that really what the trial judge did here? I mean, the trial judge wasn't saying that, was she?
Yes, the trial judge was saying exactly that. The trial judge said, you could get $4,500 from subsidies. Of course, that's a figure which did not come from anywhere. It's mystery where that figure came from. But that's exactly what the court did. Now, this was something that the judge came with sua sponte. Nobody asked that for her to consider that. She came with it, and she wanted to develop it. He asked counsel to go and find out whether this gentleman was entitled to subsidies. Well, this is something really outside of the court. What I believe a court has to do is to decide whether this person is entitled to spousal support or not, not to substitute subsidies for spousal support. The history of this has been that originally, at the time of the divorce hearing, the judge at that time decided that spousal support that he would receive is $7,000. At that time, his spouse or former spouse was making $250,000. Well, okay, she loses her job for one reason or another, so she goes down to $200,000. And then they go to court. I was not counsel at that time. They go to court, and the judge looks at it and says, okay, so she did reduce her income a certain percentage. So
what is on a motion for recalculation of spousal support, reconsideration, whatever you want to call it, what is the standard that the trial court must assess when he or she is making a determination as to whether or not spousal support should be reduced or not?
Well, the standard is that you have to look
its ability to pay and the needs of the parties.
Whether support is no longer needed or can no longer be paid. That's the standard that I'm aware of. Now, to go on and answer your question a little farther, it was clear that support was needed, no question about it. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is can it be paid any longer? Well, again, she was making $165,000 a year. That comes to $13,500 a month. That's a lot of money. And when you look at what the evidence was, that she was spending money that she should not have spent, or the court consider money that she was spending that should not have been spent.
Is it her obligation to continue working past retirement age to support your client?
No, of course not. It depends on how much money she makes. That's why we have this standard where can it be paid any longer? Well, if she retired and if she's on Social Security, $1,500 a month or whatever, of course, she's not in a position to pay. Mm-hmm. But the way that things were is that she was in a position to pay. She had undertaken to pay college expenses, rather loan for college expenses of her daughter. Then her thing was, well, it's my moral obligation to do it. Well, it may be a moral obligation to do it, but this is something that a judge should not consider, because that's not real expense that you are having.
Can I interrupt you there? A trial judge considering the amount of spousal support shouldn't think about whether or not the payor spouse wants to provide an education for their children?
The spousal support the trial judge can consider that, I agree with you. However, this should not play a role in whether that person can or cannot pay spousal support. See, what we're talking about is a daughter who is 25 years old at the time of the hearing, who was employed. We don't know how much money she was making, but there is no reason that this daughter could not pay the loan that she obtained before.
But isn't the paradigm, even the standard of living point that you make, which I've written on myself, I completely agree with the concept. But the paradigm is you place the people in the situation, if you can, roughly where they had been and would have been had it all not gone to heck in a handbasket, right?
Correct.
Well, the average person who's married to the average spouse who reaches retirement age, unless they have some job they can't give up, is going to ask for retirement benefits if it's available legally, follow up on it, do the paperwork, go to the interview, and receive it. So the idea that the court system would be doing something highly improper by, like, diverting public subsidies to deadbeat spousal support payers doesn't quite fit to me, because I would expect about the time of retirement, I'm married, been married for 29 years, I'll get retirement benefits from somebody, I hope. But he chose not to do that. Why is it unfair to say, well, I think you should have considered it. I think you should look into it at least. What's wrong with that? It just sounds so commonsensical to me.
Well, you're talking about something in the future. You're talking about retirement. This woman that the appellee.
Can I interrupt myself? I meant to say retirement and disability, because disability is the issue really that was focused on. But go ahead.
Well, there was an effort. There was a GAL appointed who went and tried to figure out what disabilities would be. and came with a very small amount, somewhere about 800 and something.
Well, my point is, if they were in fact married and not divorced, what would suggest that he would not seek SSI disability benefits if he were legally entitled to them?
Oh, I see. I don't know whether a person will go and do that, depending on what the situation of the family is.
He's not working.
The standard for disability is very high. That is, if you are making, let's say, $2,000, you're not entitled to it. So that if you have a family unit, and if the people, or let's say one of them, was making considerable amount of money, which would be shown on the income tax returns and so on, then disability will not be granted. He could not get disability. And in this case, what we had also, that I believe is important, that for many years, the best information is about 23 years at least, he was Mr. Mom. He was the one who was raising the kids. And there was the testimony of the former wife that he stopped working when the daughter was two or 3 years old, the daughter being 25, so let's say 22, 23 years, something like that. Well, that person, if that person goes and looks for Social Security or looks for disability, this will be very minimal. Social Security, as I'm sure the court is aware, is based on quarter's income. Well, he did not have that income because he did not work. So, and he still cannot work. So the question is, and I'm going back to what I started with, the question is, really, can the court, when you go for that type of hearing or for spousal support, can the court really say, no, you're not entitled to spousal support because you can go and get...
Well, let me ask you this. Suppose he actually got disability benefits and he followed through with the paperwork, followed through with the interview, and he got it. And you went to the hearing on changed circumstances. Would it be wrong for a trial judge to say, well, now that I see he's making whatever, let's just pick a number, $3,000 a month from SSI disability, okay, that factors into things. I'm not going to require as much support as I did before. Would that be a improper analysis from your perspective?
No, that would not be.
Okay, a fortiori, then why would it be wrong for a trial judge to say, look, best evidence I have is you could have gotten something. You dropped the ball, seems like on purpose, and I couldn't take that into account.
Well, see, the point here is, to follow your example, is, okay, if he was making $1,000 and his expenses were $5,000, so would the judge give him $4,000 in spousal support to make it up?
Now, your best answer would be that if the trial judge found that he was receiving $3,000 a month in SSI disability and his original spousal support obligation was $5,000, it would be improper to reduce it to $2,000 based upon simply that.
Correct.
But the more difficult question that I think Judge Kelsey is asking you, is it inappropriate for a trial judge, when considering the appropriate standard for assessing the motion before it, to consider what is available to both spouses to satisfy their own personal and financial obligations?
No, I don't think that the judge should, or the judge cannot do that. But the judge has to consider what is available at that particular time. We're talking about a present time. We're not talking about retirement, which may be 10 years, 15 years down the line. So anything that comes like that, which is not really presently available, should not be considered in that case.
If he had the potential to earn $3,000 and was not doing it, you could consider the fact that he willfully wasn't earning what he was capable of getting, couldn't you? When it came to whether he was entitled to the support to continue at the old level.
the main point
if
here,
he refused to work and the evidence was irrefutable that he had the potential, job was there waiting for him to say, I'll do it, of $3,000, you could factor that in, couldn't you?
You can factor that in, yes.
Well, why isn't this about the same thing? He has the potential to generate for himself this income. Why can't it be factored in determining whether he's entitled to have somebody else continue to pay him this support?
You're out of time, but if you'll answer Judge Bumgarner's question.
Okay. I'll try to answer it in the
No, no, you can answer it now. You're out of time completely. If you can answer his question now if you'd like.
You're getting, I believe, into imputation of income. This is something entirely different concept of what we had at this trial. What we had at this trial was very speculative. Could he get certain amount from the subsidies or not? And that's very, very something which no one really could answer at that time. So yes, if you impute income to somebody, yes, that's true. If that person could work, the person in our case, in my case, was not capable of working because that's what the two experts testified to. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Hiss?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. May it please the court. My name is Ron Hiss.
Mr. Hiss, Mr. Kavakoff, as we discussed, Mr. Kavakoff, a lot of the information regarding the first couple, three issues that were raised. If we could focus just a little bit on this issue of the trial judges holding his client in contempt of court, or holding counsel in contempt of court for failing to follow through on what the trial judge originally said, I need to have this information. Obviously, the case law, as both of you pointed out, does not require a specific order to accomplish that objective, but did the trial judge ever order anybody to do that?
How do you bring that up? The trial court never said, I order everything I have found in this hearing. Maybe it's something, and I'm looking at three very prestigious trial courts. Judge Olson, nice to see you. I've been sitting in courtrooms in one fashion or another since 1973. I've never heard a judge say, participants, everything I find, I order. Maybe this court could offer some guidance in that respect. So I'm going to tell the court, no, the trial court did not say, I order. But I would refer the court to the transcripts where Mr. Aratoon's counsel and the trial court had several pages of colloquy, and I'm using the politest terms I can use, where she explained what he and I was supposed to do. When I walked out of that courtroom, I told my staff, stop everything, this is what we're doing. It was crystal clear to me.
What's the best, where are the best lines of transcript for exactly what you said?
See Robert's brief, page 11, appendix 17 through lines 14 through 18.
Sorry,
lines 18 through 19, pages 18 through 19, lines 22 through 19.
Well, that was a lot of different lines. I looked at all those before the hearing, and I was looking for something that made it crystal clear. I'm not only expecting you guys to do this, I'm not admonishing you to try to work together, but I'm ordering this counsel to come back in, and we all walked out of trial courts knowing they have expectations of us, but we don't typically think we're subject to contempt unless there's something perfectly clear.
I'm gonna go through my memory. I know I've cited it in the many corrections I was going to offer this court. The conversation went something along these lines. Mr. Kavakoff, I'm not asking you to give me ifs, ands, and buts. I'm asking you to say, yes, you'll do this. And his response was, yes, I'll do this. It's in the transcript. I'd have to dig it out. It might take me a minute because this argument did not go anything according to what I was expecting this afternoon. So I'm kind of working from the back forward. But it's one of the things I anticipated. It was one of the more difficult things that we had to brief, one of the more difficult things we had to address. Because the trial court didn't say, Mr. Kelsey, I order you.
But I think a fair reading of this entire transcript when it relates to this issue is that Judge Nordland was struggling with how to come up with a resolution to this case and felt that the information that was available to her originally did not allow her to make a very good decision. So she essentially said, you lawyers, I need you to help me out on this. I need you to get me that information, as opposed to, and I'm going to use you as an example, counsel, I am telling you, do not come back to court next time unless you have that information.
That's close to what she said.
Okay, can you point to something in the transcript that says that?
Well, Your Honor, I'm embarrassed to say it, but I can't put my finger. I just over here in the air gave it off. I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed to say I can't direct it right to it. What a terrible word. Court's indulgence.
Yes, sir. I think the best you're going to come out with is the supplemental appendix at page 22, where the trial court noted that didn't expect the husband to do the work himself.
Right. And that's the beginning of it. I think it's probably, go back to page 17 in the appendix.
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. Go back to page 11, Robert's brief, then Robert's appendix 17, and then you start with the transcript, line 14 through 18. I just can't lay my hands on it, which is very embarrassing. Understand why.
Well, we'll don't worry about it. We'll look at it more thoroughly, of course. But do accept the idea, though, that contempt should be reserved, at least particularly with counsel, not based upon admonishments or expectations or, you know, hints, but incredibly clear directives.
The transcript is going to tell this court that the trial court not only told Mr. Kapikoff and me, she was not pleased with me either, that you do this and you work together or I'm gonna appoint a guardian ad litem. That's where the sanction came from. That's where the problem arose, and the guardian ad litem, the $3,000 fee went, I believe, directly to that guardian ad litem.
She made a finding that did not, in good faith, try to work.
The guardian ad litem did a Herculean job in the meantime, and I think Mr. Kapikoff stuck in this situation because I believe Mr. Aratune is telling him not to do any of this.
Where did the $4,500 figure come from? Is that in the guardian?
That's a combination of 862 in Virginia. I think it's slightly. Mr. Aratune was living in a hotel in Rockville, mm-hmm. Montgomery County. He was eligible for Montgomery County, Maryland, social services, et cetera, none the least of which would be what they call an advocate that works with the social services in Montgomery County, free. Food, cell phone, housing, two-bedroom apartment with his subsidy, if he was at zero, his subsidy would be like $42 or $48 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. All these things kind of came out during the trial, some of which was not on the transcript, and the $4,500 number was a moving target between about $4,000 and about $4,800. This is what he would get if he stayed in Montgomery County. Part of the research is he could have moved, and I happened to stumble upon it in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, which is not that far away. He had no reason to be in Fairfax County. In fact, Judge Smith had told him to stop bothering Judge Robert Smith in a previous hearing and issued yet another order. Did not come by Mr. Aratune had been ordered many times. stop coming by Mrs. Roberts' house in Vienna. The same hotel, same chain, same services, were $259 special in Bethlehem, in Pennsylvania, a week, where he was paying $2,000 a month, and he did, to his credit, he got it cut down to $1,500 a month, which included maid service, breakfast, you know.
Mr. Hisp, does the record support cutting all support off as opposed to simply reducing it? Because that's what happened here, right?
Given what Mr. Airtune had, given what Mr. Airtune has done with the money, and given, I believe, the trial court's lack of belief in what Mr. Airtune testified to.
So the squandering the money point plays a big role in the way you're seeing the justice of it all.
I've had three judges tell me that, three separate trial judges, and in each case, they have suggested to Mr. Airtune he needs to do something. He seems to be a moving figure, but his letter, his own evidence, said $1,250,000 that he received. If you include the $7,000 a month payments, it might be a little bit more than that. The trial court's concern, and of course the trial court rules on this on 20-109, and I had the standard in my brief. But the trial court's concern was he's just sitting there not doing anything intentionally, and this has been going on for years. And when I walk out angry, I was angry, I apologize to the trial court. I said, when we come back, I'm going to move for termination, and it's in the transcripts, termination of support. The trial court said you better have support for that. And then we started with the Smith case, which she considered, and we've had that argument, that's in the brief, and further arguments. But her goal was to give, after the actuarial testified as to Mrs. Roberts' future earnings capacity. Remember, Mrs. Roberts is the CFO of government contracting companies that are dying on the vine within 15 miles where we're sitting. Her concern was Mrs. Roberts has had to exhaust all of her retirement three times now. And here we go again. She's a 50, I'm embarrassed, 3 to 5 year old woman with a CPA that has zero retirement built up, and zero. There'll be no state of Virginia check in her mailbox when she retires. There'll be nothing but what she puts in her 401ks and whatever she's entitled to from Social Security. And it's been suggested that she sell her house. It's been suggested that she shouldn't pay for her daughter's education, a commitment both of them made, and a note she signed to Sally Mae. I'm shocked that I'm here, but we are here. And the standard of review by the trial court seems to have been met. I don't see where there is any abuse of discretion. I know exactly where the trial court was going. And to my chagrin, she gave the Mr. Airtune opportunity after opportunity after opportunity to try to help himself and to try to rebut my position.
I understand. I understand your point on that, counsel. Let me switch gears just a little bit in your remaining time to sort of help me address another issue, is the appointment of a GAL. Now, I understand conceptually why the judge thought that a GAL was needed here to help get this thing moving and to get the information that she needed to make a determination. I get all of that. But typically when you're talking about the appointment of a GAL, you have to make a determination that the person that the individual for whom the GAL is appointed is incapacitated or on a disability. Where in this record is that determination made?
She said, Mr. Airtune, I don't expect you to do it because I think I've gotten where in the order of things that was heard. She said, I don't expect you to do it. And I believe she also said your counsel's not doing it.
Okay, and then but that is an observation. That's not a legal determination of
incapacity. I do not believe she made a legal determination that he could not do it.
Okay, so if that is indeed the case, and again, I get why the judge did it, where is her authority for doing that?
I think her authority lies in the breast of the court to do something to try to help Mr. Airtune mitigate the cost that he's costing Mrs. Roberts. He's just simply not going to do anything, and his counsel, he says in his brief, doesn't want to be a social worker. And this, if it had been me, I would have gone ahead and charged everybody, Because there's only one pot of gold here, Mr. Ayrton, and he never comes up with any money, although he's living in a house in Texas. If it had been me, I would pay the guardian ad litem to get it done all the way through. Then the safety net that we all want Mr. Ayrton to have would be there, rather than he just doesn't want to do it. And this court has a very limited record. I hope they didn't send this whole file down to this court. But this is a history of using the court for the worst kind of abuse.
I think it's 5 boxes, actually.
Oh, you got half of it. That's what Judge Nordman. And I know Judge Nordman sort of. I'm always amazed how prepared she is for a case when she gets into one. She could sit there and go along and she'd pull out a transcript. She'd sit there and go along and she'd pull out a letter. It was amazing how much she knew, more than I, the file. But it was very clear. It's been very clear for the 5 years I've been litigating this disaster and prior counsel. Mr. Ayrton is just not going to do anything but try to hurt his wife till he dies.
All right. Anything further, Mr. Hiss?
Well, Your Honor, I think my brief speaks to the standard, and I think my brief speaks to the code section of the court rule number.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll greet the two of you and then adjourn.